Hello, I'm Kerry Lonergan. Welcome to the Weekly Grill. It's brought to you by Beef Central and Elanco Animal Health. Now, years ago, I was often reviewing books, and I recall getting a diet book on my desk one day and reacting with, well, mild enthusiasm. So I took it to a bush friend, a very, very good cook, and like me, she was initially lukewarm, but she called me a day later telling me that it was one of the best books she's ever read, and she was fired up with enthusiasm. By now, you might have guessed its title, The Total Wellbeing Diet, released by the CSIRO, which developed the diets mentioned in the book. Today, our guest on the grill is the co-author of that book, Professor Minnie Noakes.
Thanks for having me.
And our first question, of course, is how do you like your grill? Do you have charge of the grill when you barbecue?
Sometimes I have charge of the grill, but mostly my husband fancies himself as the master of the grill or master of the barbecue.
And what sort of a steak might you order?
Look, my favourite is always skillet steak because it's always reliably good, more expensive, but from a pure taste perspective, I don't have to be chewing a bone or anything like that. So, skillet steak's great. Lamb cutlets are always amazing.
Oh, lamb cutlets. Oh,
and,
me too.
Again, expensive, but very well worth the flavour that they provide.
And medium rare, I assume?
Yes, absolutely.
Medium. That's what everybody seems to say. Now, back to the book. Firstly, a long congratulations to you. I know it's been out for some time. But when you started this book, did you have the faintest notion it might turn into a crackerjack bestseller?
Well, we didn't really have the faintest notion that it was going to turn into a book in the first place. So what we were really doing is doing some scientific research on understanding different dietary patterns and their impact on human health, and protein and the role of protein in human health at the time was relatively undervalued. And so we really wanted to understand whether or not higher protein patterns really did provide some advantages. And in fact, we found that they did. We published some papers. And we had some media from the papers that were published, and it was from that media exposure that we were approached by publishers to write a book about it, and that's really where it started to completely take off in directions that we would never have envisaged.
I find it hard to believe that there wasn't immense research on protein up until that time. That seems extraordinary.
It was in terms of understanding some of the biology, but not in terms of the dietary patterns. And the particular dietary pattern that we looked at was, a little bit higher in animal source foods from meats and dairy, but also, relatively high in vegetables and whole grains. So it was a particular pattern that we were looking at, rather than just looking at protein per se. And we wanted to understand not only what it might do for weight control, but also to assess all the other health impacts, looking at heart health, bone health, kidney function, etc. So it was a really comprehensive 360-degree view of the health impacts of this particular dietary pattern. And it was really taking it into the marketplace that made the difference. I think it was a bit of a surprise to have a national science agency putting out a diet book when there were so many fad diet books out there on the shelf. But and we thought long and hard about whether we would add our way into what was on that shelf, but in the end we decided that we were getting so many questions and queries about the diet that putting out the book was one way of helping to communicate what we had found in a way that was more digestible than a scientific paper.
Look, I can recall it coming out, and I can recall lots of conversations over the dinner table, both at home and out in restaurants, about this book and what it was telling us. How many has it sold so far?
Well, in Australia, it's sold over a million copies, which I think a couple of times it bounced Harry Potter off the number one list, albeit very briefly.
You bounced...
Yes, it was certainly very, very, very popular in
Australia. You bounced Harry Potter.
just on the one occasion, yes. I always like to remember that particular week, which is quite amusing. And yes, it was a book that became very popular, and I think largely because it looked more like a cookbook than a scientific publication. It was very much about, well, if you're choosing a higher protein pattern, how do you do it? And it was a step-by-step process,
right,
of how you could do it. You could do it very generally, or you could follow the weekly menu plans. And, you know, I have to give a lot of credit to our publisher, Penguin, who also helped us to put it into that digestible format. I think that made all the difference, and it's what scientists need occasionally, is to connect with the commercial sector, who can really transform a piece of science into something that people can really use.
And connect is the word, isn't it? I understand it was translated to maybe, is it 15 or 20 languages overseas?
Yeah, there were a number of proposals to translate it, and it has been translated into other languages, from, I think, Arabic, Greek, Italian, and so on. There was even a US edition where we had to change a lot of the terminology and, you know, use cilantro instead of coriander and all those sorts of things. Yeah. But really it was Australia that it really made its mark, mainly because the pattern was something that Australians found easy to use. Australians generally are meat eaters, and it was an eating pattern that was very palatable, and it was also very filling, very satisfying, and that's really why it was beneficial in terms of helping people to control how much they're eating. If you're just eating carbohydrate all the time, you're going to get very hungry. But really, that's where protein comes into play. By distributing protein over the day, you're able to feel more satisfied, and thereby can help to really control some of the cravings that people often feel when they're cutting down on their calorie intake.
Professor, at that time I was reviewing books, and I can recall reading the book, and I can also recall at that time generally throughout the community, red meat was getting a bit of a hammering from so-called diet specialists in those days.
Well, it was a problem back then, and we certainly had a lot of criticism about the amount of red meat in the eating pattern. But we argued that it's the context in which you eat it. In other words, the whole dietary pattern is important, not just a particular food. And based on our work, we were able to show that really from a biological perspective, the benefits definitely outweighed any small disadvantages. The criticism about red meat does continue, though, and this is something that's a particular concern to me about some of the misinformation about the role of red meat in health, but also the role of red meat in the environment, where there are often exaggerations about the environmental footprint of red meat, whereas in fact, you know, what we really need to be concentrating on is the reduction in fossil fuels. But I won't labour that point. Suffice to say, the role of red meat in human nutrition is important, and it's particularly important in developing countries, but also it's a very nutrient-dense food, and there's really no other food that has the kind of nutrition that animal source foods do, and red meat does. And I don't think we've really even scratched the surface of some of the health benefits that red meat can bring, provided that it's eaten as part of an overall balanced eating pattern with vegetables and fruits and so on.
One of my friends in the red meat industry said this book was influential in changing the average Australian's perceptions about food. Is that a fair enough assessment?
I don't know whether I can answer that. That may be the case. But we didn't really have the industry input at that point in time. It was really more, you know, providing some of the funding for some of the studies, but that funding was really something that we approached both the dairy industry and the meat industry, because we felt that there was a story to be told around the potential benefits of higher protein patterns. So it wasn't really an influence as much as, you know, providing the, some of the finance, not all, but some of the financial support. A large majority of the financial input came from CSIRO and also from the National Health and Medical Research Council.
That's not a bad endorsement, is it? Now, I'm guessing here, but I think perceptions about fat and animal fat in particular, of course, they've changed over the years, and I don't think anyone regards them specifically as good for you, but I think the image of them as being bad has altered somewhat. Is that correct, do you think?
That is certainly true. I think the tide is turning on the role of saturated fats in human health. It hasn't shifted in the orthodox nutrition arena, but there's certainly a lot of scientific evidence emerging that, you know, it depends on the source of saturated fat, the type of saturated fat. There are many different types of saturated fat. And it also depends on what kind of eating pattern you have at the moment. And for many years, there's been a lot of research on what we call very low carbohydrate diets, starting off with the Atkins diet that was really high fat. And we did a number of studies in this space as well. And also, one of my colleagues who's still at CSIRO, Dr. Grant Brinkworth, has published a number of studies on low carbohydrate dietary patterns that do have a high level of fat. And by and large, the fact that people can lose weight on these patterns results in better biological, better health outcomes. And I think that in time we'll see that just focusing on one component in food, like saturated fat, misses the point of how people eat and the whole pattern of what we put together in a balanced diet. And I think even the low-fat story had unintended consequences where, you know, people were buying products that were labelled as low-fat or fat-free, but these turned out to be, you know, full of either sugar or refined carbohydrates that elevate insulin levels in the body, which is really bad. So we need to be really careful about promoting or denigrating foods based on one single component.
Let's take a short break now to hear a message from our podcast partner, Elanco Animal Health.
This podcast is brought to you by CompuDose, a proven way to maximise growth rates in grass-fed cattle. CompuDose allows you to target and achieve specifications for most major markets, including MSA grading and feedlots. Contact Elanco and find out how CompuDose can grow your beef operation. Results may vary depending on nutrition. Always read and follow label directions.
Welcome back to The Grill, and today our guest, Professor Mennie Noakes, author of the CSIRO big seller, The Total Wellbeing Diet. Now, nutrition, MLA has had quite some domestic nutrition advertising. Has this been effective, do you think, in terms of its relationship with red meat? I'm wondering if Australia's perceptions of red meat consumption have changed considerably since that heady days of 2005 and afterwards.
Look, I think in general, meat consumption has gradually gone down. The question is that because people are concerned about meat, or is that because meat has become more expensive? I think in general, there is in the younger population a belief about animal source foods and animal rights issues, and I think some of that might result in some of the shifts and the reductions in meat consumption in some parts of the population, particularly the younger ones. But by and large, the majority of the population still continues to purchase meat and red meat on a regular basis, and has some of the studies that MLA has done have shown that, you know, they have a very positive attitude to our farmers and our livestock farmers. So, you know, whilst there's a lot of noise from fringe groups, I think by and large, the Australian population is still a meat-eating population and continues to, and is likely to continue to do so. The real issue with health is that people are eating way too much junk food, and that's the elephant in the room that sometimes gets forgotten when people talk about, you know, meatless Monday. I'd rather see junk food less Monday than a meatless Monday. It'd be far more productive.
I think a lot of people would agree with you on that. Now, look, the current Australian dietary guidelines recommend only 130 grams of red meat every second day. Would the average adult Australian realistically eat only 130 grams of red meat in a sitting? I think, I mean, the current advice adds up to the equivalent of, it's about 450 grams, or what's 1 pound in the old language, of red meat a week. I have friends, and maybe I'm among them, these people at that moment, I would eat all that in one sitting.
You may not eat that every day. And I think the dietary guidelines are very much influenced by the epidemiology on the link between the supposed link between red meat and colorectal cancer. And there are a lot of studies now, more recent studies, showing that that link is very tenuous. And there are a number of researchers who argue that that link is a confounder. In other words, sometimes people in studies that eat a lot of meat also eat, you know, may drink a lot of alcohol, may exercise less and so on, so that it may be a completely false relationship. And it's also the case that these studies don't prove that red meat is a cause of any adverse health effect. So I think if we start to look at the science much more critically, the reason for the restrictions are really a bit tenuous. I think where the dietary guidelines might be challenged in this next iteration is whether meat should be further restricted for environmental reasons. And there I think we're getting into some very, very shaky ground in terms of, you know, what is the impact of restricting meat even further when red meat provides a large chunk of nutrients to the Australian diet. And it concerns me that in places like the UK, some universities have chosen to take meat off their cafeteria menu. In the US, there's evidence that some childcare centres have removed red meat for reasons that relate to environmental impacts. Now, this is really an alarming situation where you have a food that really is highly nutritious, but also has become highly politicised and also misrepresented. So I do think it's something that the industry needs to be paying a lot of attention to, because it can start to become a significant player as the role of the diet and the environment becomes much more central in people's minds, and people obviously want to do something about it. But it is really a smokescreen for the things that are really important, and really the fossil fuel industry is one that contributes the biggest climate impact, and that's where we need to be concentrating our efforts. Also, I think eating too much food overall is our biggest problem. You know, we as a nation and as a developed nations, 60% of people in Australia are overweight or obese. There's plenty of room to reduce our environmental impact by eating less junk food. And this is some of the work that we did at CSIRO as well, that about 30% of our environmental footprint, greenhouse gas footprint, comes from junk foods. This is where we need to be concentrating our efforts, not necessarily reducing our red meat intake, because that intake can provide valuable nutrition.
Yes, the industry bodies perhaps should be more on the front foot and being proactive rather than reactive. But it leads to my next question. How much are the typical consumer's meat purchasing decisions today influenced by nutrition as opposed to issues like price or environmental impact of red meat production?
In surveys, people tend to say it's right up there, maybe number two or number three, but it's certainly not number one. I think number one would probably be price and taste. That's always going to be right up there. But people do think about health, not so much nutrition maybe, but they do think about health and what's good for me, what's good for the family. But, you know, something can be a really great food that's good for you, but if it doesn't taste any good, if it's too expensive, people aren't going to buy it. I think that it is important, though, that, you know, we continue to see red meat as a healthy food, Australian meat in general, and the way that it's raised is an excellent food. And so, you know, I think it will continue to be part of our eating pattern. But I do think that, you know, it needs to be continued to be promoted in terms of its health benefits. And it isn't just that it contains iron and zinc and protein. It contains so many other components that we've only begun to scratch the surface of. So there's a lot more to tell in the story of the nutrition composition and the health benefits of red meat, and also the environmental credentials. You know, there are a number of farmers in Australia, many farmers that look after their land as well as raise animals and ensure that they maintain biodiversity in their environment. So I think we're becoming a more environmentally conscious production system as a whole. And I think that that's being promoted more and more over time.
So in summary, Professor, meat, but in moderation, maybe three times a week.
Well, I personally don't. My feeling is that the evidence to restrict meat is very tenuous. So whilst the dietary guidelines might say restrict meat to a particular amount, the evidence doesn't really support that, in my view. I'll go out on a limb and say that. I think the important thing about eating red meat is that it needs to be part of a healthy diet. So if you're having red meat with vegetables at dinner and you're not overeating a lot of junk food, then I think that's a very good outcome. Counting grams of red meat is probably not that helpful, I don't think, but you know, making sure that we're eating a balanced diet with meat as a part of that, but cutting back on junk foods like, you know, pastries and cakes and mostly carbohydrate foods, to be perfectly honest. Of course, alcohol is incorporated in that. We probably could cut down a bit on that as well. But, you know, red meat has got an important place in human health, and I think any further restrictions is misdirected.
Professor Mandy Noakes, author of The Total Wellbeing Diet. Look, thank you so much for that terrific interview. We've all learned a lot from listening to you today and from reading your book. Congratulations again, and thanks for being with us on The Grill.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
And thank you for joining me today. Until next time, I'm Kerry Lonigan, and this is The Weekly Grill, brought to you by Beef Central and our podcast partner, Elanco Animal Health.